Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Thursday edition of the Damage Report. We are proceeding quickly through this week and we've got a lot to get to through the course of today's episode. At the very end, you're gonna wanna stick around because Brooke is gonna be joining me at the desk and we're gonna be evaluating the video that Joe Biden put out about the now 7 women who have had uncomfortable interactions with him. And we're going to be evaluating it. Not evaluating whether it's a good enough apology because there's not technically any apology in it, but we will be evaluating it and giving you updates on the most recent news about that. Also, a lot of you have been asking for a long time, John, when are you gonna talk about forced arbitration? Today's that day, people, buckle up. The House had a hearing about it, and it is actually very important. We've got some great questioning from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in that area, so we're gonna be talking about that. Cybersecurity, flooding in the Midwest, Donald Trump's taxes, everything. But before we get into that, I do wanna give you an update on the most important news of the last week, I guess. I have now begun peeling. My sunburn is proceeding along and it is still really bad, man. Please wear sunscreen. Take the sun seriously. Doesn't matter if it doesn't look that sunny. It can still do a lot of damage to you and I'm suffering right now, which is why I still have not been able to put a jacket on. But anyway, with that, also, by the way, almost as important, the House has apparently once again passed the resolution invoking the War Powers Act and calling for the US to cut off its involvement with the Saudi-led war on Yemen, joining the Senate, which has already done that. That will now go to Donald Trump, who is expected to veto it because he's just the worst. But at least Congress has acted and made clear that there's no reason or rationale for the US being involved in this conflict any longer. We will see if he does veto it, what happens in terms of reaction from the people. Again, he has not done many vetoes. This would be, I believe, the second. And also the possibility that the veto could be overridden. It seems unlikely. There are very few reasonable Republicans, but we will update you on that as it proceeds. Hopefully we'll be able to have Ro Khanna back on since he was the one who was sort of shepherding this along for well over a year. But with that, we jump into domestic politics and breaking news as of last night. We found out late last night that some members of the Mueller team are apparently not satisfied with the interpretation of the Mueller report that was provided by William Barr in his initial summary sort of letter that he put together. Shocking nobody. I mean, we got the 4-page letter from Barr. It had less than 100 words from the actual report. At the time, reasonable people were saying, everybody pump the brakes. Let's find out what's in the actual report. We don't necessarily have to just assume that everything that's in a summary is going to be borne out by the final more than 400-page report. And if we were going to rely on a summary, we probably wouldn't want to do it from William Barr, a guy whose audition for that position was a 19-page letter, 5 times longer, by the way, saying that obstruction of justice was a ridiculous charge to levy against Donald Trump in the first place. I made an analogy last night. It would be like if you're anticipating Game of Thrones season 8 and you see the 1-minute trailer and you're like, I got it. I know everything that happens from here on out. And then you find out that trailer was actually edited by Cersei Lannister. It possibly doesn't give you the full picture. And again, it doesn't mean that what was in the trailer or in the Barr letter won't be borne out. I mean, Cersei can only use the footage that was shot, I guess. But you can just wait. The show is gonna premiere. The Mueller report will be released. We can just wait for that. All of us were faced with the choice. When we initially found out that the Mueller report was finished and when the Barr summary was released, we could jump to conclusions or we could just wait and find out. And many people Scrooge McDucked that thing and they were just like, I jump in it. And now they might find out that they're less Scrooge McDuck and more Peter Griffin from Family Guy and finds out that the gold coins aren't actually liquid and when you hit it, you actually splatter on it. Maybe just wait and find out. But let me go over some of what was revealed by the New York Times from these leaks that came out. And just briefly notice, they've done almost no leaking over the course of a 2-year investigation. There's been very little that's actually been revealed and yet this has come out. That implies that they're pretty frustrated if for once they are actually doing some leaking. But here's what they said. Some of Robert Mueller's investigators have told Associates that Attorney General William Barr failed to adequately portray the findings of their inquiry and that they were more troubling for President Trump than Mr. Barr indicated. Okay, and I'm gonna read the rest of the sentence just because I love the terminology. According to government officials and others familiar with their simmering frustrations. That is a nice turn of phrase there. The Washington Post reported that one anonymous source said it was much more acute than Barr suggested. And some members of Mr. Mueller's team are concerned that because Mr. Barr created the first narrative of the special counsel's findings, Americans' views will have hardened before the investigation's conclusions become public. And that is not only a possibility, but I would have to assume that was the point all along. Everybody wants to set the terms that we will talk about this by before we ever actually have the report. It is the reasonable course is to wait until we actually have the information and then evaluate it based on what's in there, which again, another pointless caveat that no one will acknowledge might in the end buttress everything that William Barr said and add nothing substantive to the conversation. But we lose nothing by being patient and waiting. Again, it's going to come out. But there's a lot of views to be had and people want their articles to be read and you know all of that. And that's why people like Sean Hannity were jumping all over this thing. And Barr and Donald Trump and his messaging about it, he wants to be the one to write the headlines. And he hopes that people, when the report actually comes out, won't even care. They'll think that they already know what's in it. So why pay attention to anything new that might come about if there is something new that comes about? And specifically, their frustrations with the summary apparently are driven by the fact that they had themselves produced summaries of the report that Barr chose not to use. The investigators had written multiple summaries and some team members believe that Mr. Barr should have included more of the material in the 4-page letter that he wrote just a couple of weeks ago. And they say specifically that the special counsel report was written in such a way that it would have allowed the front matter from each section to be released immediately or very quickly. So the idea is they had different sections on different things. So one might be the possibility of conspiracy, one might be obstruction of justice. And they produced basically like a thesis at the beginning of each one that could have been released and would have been more substantive. He chose not to use that. Now, after this information came out, the DOJ has said that no, there was stuff in there that pertained to ongoing investigations. It would have required too much vetting or redacting or whatever. That is possible. I would have to assume that Robert Mueller probably did not load those self-selected summaries with a bunch of classified information. That doesn't seem like his MO. It's possible that's the case. And in the end, we will see those summaries and we will know if they were filled with classified information or if this is just a cover for Barr's activities being released after this negative information comes out. And let's see, what's interesting too is that you have people on Mueller's team. And again, we don't know how widespread these frustrations are. I mean, the team had dozens of people on it. It might be that three people are frustrated and it doesn't actually represent much or amount to much. Or it could be that it's a pretty common feeling across the team. We will again have to wait to find out. But while they are frustrated, Barr himself is apparently frustrated. There's a quote from New York Times. Mr. Barr and other Justice Department officials believe the special counsel's investigators fell short of their task by declining to decide whether Mr. Trump illegally obstructed the inquiry, according to two government officials, which that is rich, as they say. Yes, I believe Barr is really frustrated that Mueller didn't decide if he had broken the law on obstructing justice. And he just hated that the responsibility fell to him as the person who was put there to try to protect Trump on this charge. And again, just to return to, this has nothing to do with the conspiracy or coordination or anything like that. This is the obstruction, which I am more interested in. I understand that very few people are interested in that. Sean Hannity doesn't care what the evidence of obstruction of justice is going to be. He doesn't care if justice was obstructed. He wanted Trump to obstruct justice. And that is very frustrating for someone who is worried about the precedent that is being set by both this investigation, the response to it, and all of that. The idea that we should not care whether a president shuts down an inquiry into possible illegal activity, that should scare us more than anything else because that's applicable to virtually any future law breaking. I mean, imagine if you had any other president, like if you're not particularly interested in what Trump might have gotten up to, what if it had been Hillary Clinton or if it had been Bernie or Obama or George W. Bush and they have broken the law or we believe that they've broken the law. And we want there to be justice. We want there to be an investigation. Coming out of this and the media narrative around the Barr summary, why would any president allow a special counsel investigation to proceed? I mean, why not just do what Trump has done? You can literally fire the head of the FBI. You can publicly attack your attorney general for like 2 years because they didn't protect you from this investigation. You can go on TV and admit that you fired the FBI director. You can continually attack the investigators, even calling them treasonous and lying about their political affiliation to discredit the investigation. You can continually badger and harass and threaten witnesses, calling them rats if they cooperate with the investigation. You can blatantly dangle pardons for people to stop them from cooperating with the investigation. And that goes for any future law breaking. Why would any president abide anything that could potentially reveal laws that they had broken when the precedent has now been set that we don't give a damn if they obstruct justice? And so that is very scary. And that is why in that particular area of the Mueller report, I am very interested to see what they actually had, because apparently the story is not as simple as was portrayed by William Barr. And again, more caveats. In the end, nothing may change, but there is no harm whatsoever in actually waiting to find out what's in the real report rather than jumping into what we want to be there, our interpretations of William Barr's summary so far. With that said, let's jump to another topic, semi-related. We may, in the end, actually get Donald Trump's taxes. After waiting several months, House Dems are now pushing for it to be revealed. There is apparently legal footing for them to get those taxes. A law passed in 1924 gives the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee the power to request any individual's tax returns from the Treasury Department for review in closed session. That includes the president. Now, that legal authority should never need to be exercised, because it's been a longstanding tradition that you get to see the president's taxes. That is sort of a necessary part of understanding if they're going to abide by the law as president. And as far back as February of 2015, when Trump was still just considering running, he told Hugh Hewitt that if he ran, quote, I would release tax returns. Then after getting in the race in August of 2015, he said, at some point, I'll release it. But if you've been paying attention to politics over the past couple of years, you know that that never happened. And his excuses about why he wouldn't release his taxes evolved over time. He eventually settled on, I'm under audit. That yes, all of his taxes going back his entire life are being audited still. Now, we know that that's a lie. We also know that it doesn't matter if they're being audited. He could still release his taxes. He chooses not to. But the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, he promised during the campaign that he would get the taxes. He's now doing that. They are looking for the 2013 to 2018 federal income tax returns for Trump, entities connected to him, including business entities, and also information about any audits that are ongoing. Now, understand, he's not asking Trump to release these things. He's going directly to the Treasury Department. And so we will finally find out, were those audits actually going on? Now, in the end, again, it doesn't matter. You could still release the taxes, but we want to know for sure if he was lying and what is in actually in those taxes. Now, after it was revealed that they would be getting them, Trump was asked about this, and he said he's still under audit. I'm always under audit, it seems. And he says he's not inclined to release his returns. But again, I'll remind you, the request was to the IRS. It was not to him. That was pointed out on Twitter by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said, Congress, we're going to need a copy of the president's tax returns. Trump, no, I'm under audit. Congress, we didn't ask you, which I just love. And this is one of the representations of why a change in control of Congress is pretty important, because finally you have people who care whether the law is actually being abided by. Now, does this mean that we're going to get the taxes anytime soon? Not necessarily, despite the fact that the law is incredibly clear that they can get those taxes. They can't necessarily release them publicly. It's for a sort of internal review, but they can't get them. That doesn't mean that we're going to get them. Steve Mnuchin might decide that his position is less being in the Treasury Department to abide by the law and more to protect Donald Trump from any sort of scrutiny. So he might block it. It might start an ongoing, perhaps long court process, but at least the process has begun. And there is some chance that before the 2020 election, we will actually know what Donald Trump has been so scared will be revealed when his taxes are finally public. Anyway, with that, we are going to take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Stick around. Significant portions of the Midwest are still dealing with the devastating flooding of the past few weeks, but some of the areas actually have received far less media attention than others. And joining us now to break this down and the effort to rebuild after the flooding is Harold Frazier, chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Chairman Frazier, welcome to the Damage Report.
Yep, hello, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. And so for those who might not have seen in real time the damage that was done from the flooding in that region and to multiple reservations, including Pine Ridge, Cheyenne River, Rosebud, how bad was the damage?
Well, you know, one of the things we're still assessing, we have a river on a reservation called the Morrow River, and that has flooded. One of the things, so some of the areas that we're still not able to get to because of the water still there, we have shut down a bridge because there has been damage done to it. And it's one of our major BIA roads coming out of the community, Whitehorse. It's impacting our, one of the most important thing is our school children. They're having to travel an extra about 50 miles one day to go to school. So that bridge is still closed down. Our roads from Whitehorse to Promise, the BIA Route 3, that is currently closed. We have huge washouts. Some part of the road is just half of its left. And it's pretty tough to assess right now.
Wow, and so important for people to understand that, like, some people might have thought, oh, I saw that news a couple of weeks ago, I guess now things must be better, but that it is still affecting many communities. And I'm curious, as the initial flooding was happening and as the initial response to it began, how much assistance were different communities in this area receiving, either from the state or from the federal government in terms of manpower and money? What was there significant assistance?
You know, we really haven't had much assistance, too much. We were able to get a lot of sandbags. However, we had to pay for the sand, the manpower. In addition, I was thankful there's a lot of volunteers that stepped up and helped us, with the sandbagging and so forth. But as far as the federal government, we never really got much assistance. We were able to, through the state, we were able to get a swift water rescue team on standby. So that was, all the help that we had received.
I'm curious, in terms of the history of flooding like this, does this stand out as one of the worst instances, or is this something that some of these communities have had to deal with in recent decades?
We have had some floodings down there in the past, but this has really been the worst. And the reason why is there's a lot of siltation that had built along the river and so forth. There's a lot of damage done to culverts that rerouted to waters. And it's just the biggest problem that along that river is back in the 1960s when the Corps of Engineers built Lake Oahe or the Oahe Dam, the mouth of the Morrow River, where before it floods in it, there was a bridge they constructed. We call it the Promise Bridge. And it was built real narrow, And so a lot of times ice jams in there, trees, and it backs up the water. And that's where a lot of our problems stem from, is this small bridge. Also, too, there was a railroad line through that area, and they taken out the bridge, but they left the pillars, they left the grade, the berm, and it's really hard for that water to go down there swiftly, so that always backs up on that river. But just through the years that we have had flooding, that siltation really built up, and anymore it ain't going to take much water coming down before we have major floods again.
Wow. Continue.
Oh, and one of the biggest challenges is repairing our roads. We only get 2.2 million a year to try to maintain about 1,500 miles of roads. And we had to shut down because of the river caving off and cutting into the roads. We had to shut a portion of the road off now, and they got a detour around. So when we get the road open, there will be a detour, hopefully not too long. Hopefully we get the resources that we can to try to reroute the road. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges.
And I'm hoping that by people continuing to talk about this and the challenges that remain, that there will be pressure put on these governments, either at the state or the federal level, to make some of the improvements and suggestions that you've pointed out to stop the damage from future flooding being worse than it needs to be. But for those who might be watching this, is there anything that they can do to assist in the recovery and the rebuilding?
You know, I think, you know, just keep supporting us. Contact your congressional people, the leaders of the government, to not forget us. Right now, that's one of the things we have. We presently have a bridge. This bridge shut down, and we need a bridge inspector to come inspect it, assure its safety, and as well as three other bridges. But because of the flooding in the other area, we are told that there won't be a bridge inspector coming here on Cheyenne River till next week. So that's another big issue, is it seemed like there's just not enough staff detailed. Maybe that's something the federal government needs to do, is detail more bodies up in our areas to, you know, try to get our roads repaired or bridges, you know, because like I mentioned, it's really affecting especially our school children.
Yeah, and hopefully again that the pressure can help them to reassess their priorities in getting people there as soon as possible. Well, Harold Frazier, chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Yep, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. We come back, congressional testimony over forced arbitration that strips literally dozens and dozens of millions of Americans of the ability to get legal recourse if they are abused by their corporations that they work for. Some interesting progress in that area that we'll break down after this. On a daily basis, new Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez fulfills for me two purposes, thankfully, at least a few times a week. One is inspiring me to not quit this career just straight out and just move on to something else, open up a board game cafe or something like that. And the other is making incredibly generally unsexy topics interesting and approachable and seeming more relevant. And we've got that here today with forced arbitration, which sounds really boring, I admit, but it is incredibly important and a very common thing. So in effect, with forced arbitration, if you're working for a company and you have to sign a forced arbitration clause, if you believe that they have abused you in some fashion, if they've broken the law, if they've taken your pay, if you've been sexually harassed, rather than actually being able to go to the courts to seek justice, you have to go through an internal mechanism inside of that corporation, which in theory and in the best case scenario is still relatively independent from the operation of the corporation. But in practice, and you know, that's not the way it actually works out. So why are these even still a thing? Why? That doesn't seem fair whatsoever. It seems inherently anti-worker. Well, there had been a little bit of progress in ending these forced arbitration proceedings and, you know, the expansion of them throughout more and more corporations. But then the lobby, so there was a new law or new regulation, I should say, under Barack Obama. But then in 2017, gigantic industry lobby groups lobbied Congress to oppose that rule back in the Obama era, where under the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it would have prohibited companies from banning class action lawsuits in consumer arbitration clauses. So it would not have gotten rid of all of forced arbitration, but in the biggest cases, these class action lawsuits, it would have made it easier for people to get actual justice. But that lobby effort by the industry was successful. And all but two Republicans voted to revoke the rule. That resulted in Vice President Mike Pence casting the tie-breaking vote. And in November of 2017, President Donald Trump signed the joint resolution. The rule was revoked. So we've been moving in the exact wrong direction on this, as in so many different issues. Now, this matters because in forced arbitration, workers are less likely to win their cases. And when they do win, they tend to get much less money than they would in court. But there's actually other reasons that these forced arbitration scenarios are so subversive, which AOC is going to lay bare. But again, just in terms of the stakes, I want you to understand how big of a thing this is. About 60 million American workers are under these sorts of agreements. That is about half of all non-unionized workers. Now, of course, one of the chief things a union would achieve is not forcing you into this sort of situation. So for non-unionized workers, companies have been incredibly successful in growing these to be a bigger and bigger portion of the workforce. So now we finally have a hearing, which technically the Republicans called. So this is a good thing. There seem to be some Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, who deserves credit for virtually nothing, except in this area, he seems to be at least willing to have a public conversation about the future of these sorts of agreements. And in it, AOC was doing some great questioning. Here is the first section.
Would you say, Mr. Gregg, that arbitration clauses have been used to circumvent the courts on a wide range of issues?
Correct.
Of potential misconduct?
Yes. So it's used against workers when it relates to sexual harassment or discrimination, wage theft. It's used in the consumer context when you have a dispute over your credit card or student loans.
So if.
Okay, so you see there, it affects a wide range of different complaints against the corporations. But as I said before, it actually has a more subversive and sort of chilling effect on us being able to even know what these corporations are getting up to. And in this next section, AOC is going to tie this forced arbitration in with climate change, actually. And she's going to explain beautifully how this works in favor of corporations.
Would you say, Mr. Gregg, that arbitration clauses have been used to circumvent the courts on a wide range of issues?
Correct.
Of potential misconduct?
Yes. So it's used against workers when it relates to sexual harassment or discrimination, wage theft. It's used in the consumer context when you have a dispute over your credit card or student loans.
So if you're a company and you tuck this clause into virtually anything that you can make an employee or a consumer sign, whether it's a credit card agreement, whether it's an employment contract, you can essentially absolve yourself from almost any form of corporate misconduct. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what will happen.
Pre-dispute arbitration clauses have developed in the brokerage business. That's what's happened.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just have to reclaim my time very quickly. But thank you. So you would agree?
Yes.
Mr. Gregg, I'm interested here in the wider impact. You know, we're talking about not just issues of discrimination and worker abuse, but even on a macro level and potentially macroeconomic level. In fact, a federal court now is allowing a lawsuit by Exxon investors to move forward. Investors claim that Exxon knew and kept secret for years internal reports showing that they knew climate change and they knew that climate change was real and that the fossil fuels and their role in producing fossil fuels contributes to the role of climate change. Yet, they undertook a misinformation campaign to hide those internal findings and reports, including.
Okay, so what she is describing there is that we might, in this particular case, have this sort of what is effectively a class action suit against a fossil fuel company being moved out of the shadows and into the public eye in courts. And the important thing there is, it's not just that in this forced private arbitration, you're less likely to actually get justice, or that when you are, you're less likely to make as much money and things like that. It's that regardless of whether you win or lose, it is a private process, which means that when you are revealing what a corporation has done, which can be as individual as like a sexual assault claim or something like that, to as broad as decades of hiding the evidence that their product is contributing to climate change, Whether you win or lose in forced arbitration, the public doesn't actually find out the details of that, which means that in the end, it's really a win-win for the corporation when it's something as broad as contributing to climate change. Okay, so if it goes into forced arbitration, and if in the end the individual employees end up making a little bit of money, what's important is that the public doesn't understand how much the companies actually knew and when they actually knew it. That is what is so subversive and so chilling about this. It's that it hides what these corporations are getting up to. It doesn't just hurt the individuals, it hurts the company, or I should say the country at large. And so I don't know that coming out of this will actually have any progress. I don't know if Republicans will actually change their tune on this and finally have some sort of reforms that scale back either the amount of forced arbitration clauses or the sort of topic areas that can be adjudicated under forced arbitration. But it is very important, not just for individual workers' rights, but also possibly the future of our species in the area of climate change, that we have some actual reform in this area. And thankfully, it looks like there are some good both Democrats like AOC and some Republicans willing to at least have the conversation. And sort of related to this, it has been interesting over the past 6 months or so that as we've seen AOC, as we've demonstrated in videos even on today's program, as she has risen as sort of the figurehead of the Democratic Party and one of the best communicators for both progressive values, but also on a wide range of progressive issues, and she's been attacked a lot, but not really from Donald Trump. He actually has been very hands off as she has risen to match and perhaps exceed him in success in using social media to push her values and her issues. But Donald Trump has finally actually brought her up. And during a speech where we rightfully in the first day focused on him saying that wind turbines cause cancer or that he doesn't know where his father was born, here is something he had to say about AOC.
Now, I'm only afraid that we're going to be too hard on the Green New Deal and they're not going to do it. Because I want them to do it. We don't want to have them knock it out before we get to run against it. So let's take it easy. I'm actually saying it's a wonderful thing. The Green New Deal, done by a young bartender, 29 years old. A young bartender, wonderful young woman.
So first of all, let's just briefly acknowledge how fundamentally misogynistic that is. Like, oh, she's a young that's all. She's just a young bartender. She's not, you know, the youngest person ever to enter Congress in the history of the United States. You know, huge up and comer, incredibly respected for her expertise and ability to communicate on a wide range of issues. She's just a young bartender. Okay, so if he is going to attempt to tangle with her, he is going to do so in exactly the way that he's addressed past people like Hillary Clinton and others, incredibly disingenuously. I wonder how this is going to work out for him, though. He needs to say something. The right is calling for it. They want people to fight back against what they now see as a big threat to their dominance in government that they've had for the past couple of years. And so many people have attempted to take down AOC. It generally hasn't gone too well for them. And AOC actually sort of recognized that, and she responded to Trump's comments saying, "The last guy who underestimated me lost. That's all I've got to say about that." Talking about Joe Crowley. And the thing is, like, I understand everybody thinks, oh, you know, Donald Trump is unbeatable online. He's got so many followers and all that. How has it worked out for everybody else so far? Do you really want her and her fans turned on you? So Donald Trump has dipped his toe in the water. By the way, let's acknowledge another alpha move by Donald Trump. Won't even say her name. It's like Voldemort. He's scared that he's going to invoke her wrath. We'll see in the long term how that actually works against him. Both in a personal feud with AOC, but then also substantively on the Green New Deal. He says he wants to run on it. It's incredibly popular, far more popular than he or anyone else in that room listening to him speak actually is. So we'll see in the end if he comes to regret his wishes there. Okay, we are going to take a short break. We come back, cybersecurity, what companies are being targeted by phishing attacks? We'll have that for you after this. Some of the biggest brands in the world are finding themselves coming under both more common and more sophisticated cyber attacks on a constant basis. And joining us now to break down which brands are being targeted the most recently, CEO of Area One Security, Oren Falkowitz. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I'm very curious, you've put together a list of, I believe, the 64 most targeted brands. And who are some of the standouts that made it on that list?
Well, what we see is that cyber attackers continue to use authenticity as their greatest weapon, not sophistication in code. And the brands that we trust most financial institutions, large cloud providers, PayPal, Apple, Facebook, continue to be the primary things that are being used to lure users and cause cyber damages around the world.
So it sounds like from some of the ones that you listed there that it's some of these are like more digital or more tech focused companies. Were there any on the list that, you know, aren't thought of as being like a primarily sort of digital or technology focused corporation?
A large majority of them are financial institutions, you're right, digital organizations. We saw that the top 64 brands in the world represented about 89% of the phishing around the world this year. About half of the attacks are coming from US-based companies, but brands from Europe and Canada, Asia and South America, they're also increasing in their prevalence.
So if you could describe, I understand that the techniques that the people doing these attacks that they use are probably pretty diverse, but what are some of the forms that these attacks might come in?
Yeah, so today when there's cybersecurity damages, whether it's financial loss or data loss, we're seeing that in 9 in 10 of those incidents, phishing is the root cause of that. And what phishing is it's an attempt to get a user to click on a link or download a file. So you might receive an email in your work business account or your personal email account that says, hey, your Microsoft password needs to be reset. And when you click on that link, you go to a website and it looks exactly like the legitimate Microsoft password reset website. But when you do enter your username and password there, hackers are stealing that data and they're using it to log into your account. It might look like one of the largest institutions says, hey, we need you to send us some information. And those are the ways that these attacks are happening.
And do we have any idea of the amount of damage, like in terms of dollars or lost productivity or anything like that caused by these sorts of attacks in a given year?
Well, what we know is that 95% of the damages worldwide can be attributed to phishing. The financial numbers are consistently growing. Unfortunately, most of the damages go unreported. There's very little here within the United States. There's more with the adoption of the GDPR regulations in Europe that requires companies to report or to highlight when there's been a data loss or data breach. So we don't, I wouldn't speculate as to what those numbers are, but any estimates, are significant. And you only need to look in the newspaper every day to see that every company around the world is being impacted, whether it's a Fortune 500 company or a small and medium business or enterprise, everyone is having this. And of course, you're familiar on this program with what happened in the elections in 2016, mm-hmm. the types of cyber attacks that happened in 2018, and the impending cyber attacks that are already ongoing for the 2020 elections. Those are all a start from phishing attacks. And the techniques that we outline here, and we put together in our March Hacktus bracket, those are the ones that that cause the most damage.
So look, I mean, you're talking about areas of either elections or these financial companies. Obviously, there's a great concern that someone could be impacted by this. You work for a cybersecurity company. You're a CEO of Area 1 Security. In your view, are corporations taking seriously the rise of these sorts of phishing attacks? Are they doing what's necessary to try to limit the damage?
Well, clearly not. There's so much more to do. And what we find is that, not enough people are taking action early enough attacks by focusing primarily on the phishing problem. As damages increase and get more publicity and more recognition, people do take action, but we find it's mostly responding in a post-breach scenario versus being preemptive to it in the front. I expect that to change. It gets better every year, but we're certainly nowhere near where we need to be for there to be the right kinds of outcomes.
Yeah, and hopefully some of the companies that have appeared on your list as a result of that might start to take it more seriously. So,
I just want to be clear that the companies that appear on our list are not the victims. They're the ones whose brands are being used to launch attacks against other folks. And so, those companies like JP Morgan Chase, just today, CEO Jamie Dimon, highlighted that cybersecurity is the greatest risk to the financial system. And they spend about $600 million a year and take this very seriously. Hmm. It turns out that their brand, though, is being used to attack everyone else around the world. There's more to do, and we expect to be able to help folks on that front.
Yeah, and so individuals should of course also be aware that these sorts of attacks might be happening and should take the precautions that they can as well. Oren Falkowitz, CEO of Area 1 Security, thank you for joining us and breaking us down.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Joe Biden facing more accusations of inappropriate behavior, and he has now issued a video responding to these accusations. Myself and Brooke will be responding to that after this break. Welcome back. Just minutes remaining in this episode. Brooke is here.
Yay!
Brooke, glad to have you here.
Yeah, thank I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
One story we're gonna break down, okay. So let's talk about it. Joe Biden now facing apparently at least 7, as of when we're filming this, women who say that they have had uncomfortable interactions with him over the years. Now, none saying that they feel that their interaction was sexual, but uncomfortable and inappropriate. And there's the certain possibility that more will come out. We have details on those. But before that, Joe Biden has finally responded to these this variety of different women and saying the experiences they had. He's put out a video, and here it is.
Folks, in the coming month, I expect to be talking to you about a whole lot of issues, and I'll always be direct with you. But today, I want to talk about gestures of support and encouragement that I've made to women and some men that have made them uncomfortable. And I always try to be, in my career, I've always tried to make a human connection. That's my responsibility, I think. I shake hands, I hug people, I grab men and women by the shoulders and say, you can do this. And whether they're women, men, young, old, it's the way I've always been. It's the way I've tried to show I care about them and I'm listening. And over the years, knowing what I've been through, the things that I've faced, I've found that scores, if not hundreds of people have come up to me and reached out for solace and comfort, something, anything that may help them get through the tragedy they're going through. And so it's just who I am. And I've never thought of politics as cold and antiseptic. I've always thought it about connecting with people. As I said, shaking hands, hands on the shoulder, a hug, encouragement. And now it's all about taking selfies together. Social norms have begun to change. They've shifted. And the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility.
Okay, so there is a little bit more to the video you can find on his Twitter account. We're gonna break down our response to it. What I will say is what you won't find even in the rest of the video is the words, I'm sorry or I apologize. Maybe I'm focusing too much on individual word choice. Do you think it matters that this is a response and not an apology for any of that?
Okay, because you know I hate a fake apology. Mm-hmm. I hate an almost apology, but this felt like an apology to me.
It did feel like an apology,
but
so you don't think it matters that
you don't say the words, I'm sorry.
Or I apologize. It was him attempting to explain what he felt he was doing accepting that he needs to change.
I hear you. I understand I made you uncomfortable. I won't do it again.
Mm-hmm. So you think that's as good?
I guess so, but then now I hadn't even thought of that. I hadn't even noticed that because he did those three things, which is usually like what's missing.
Even when someone does apologize.
Wait, exactly. So I didn't even notice that. And I think if this were the first time he has almost but not really apologized, like mm-hmm. said those words, but now I'm reminded of Anita Hill. And we're still tiptoeing and doing weird things like around just saying, I didn't do everything I could have to protect how you were treated during those hearings. Mm-hmm. Like, so maybe you're right. Now I have my head just exploded. I need a moment, you know.
I mean, the thing is, I think most people agree with him that he didn't think he was being sexual, but it isn't necessarily up to the individual. Anna Kasparian posted on Facebook, like, imagine, I would never imagine one of my male coworkers doing an Eskimo kiss to me.
Yeah, no, that's, like, it's a lot.
Like,
yeah.
And if I were to Eskimo kiss Anna and then say, that's not sexual, okay, I can say that. That doesn't necessarily matter though. And so look, I think he's saying he's not going to do it anymore. And it's always going to be up to the women that have had these interactions. Uh-huh. And they don't say that what he did was illegal or anything like that. But it is still odd to not get in the time that those were not appropriate things. You don't smell people's hair.
Right,
like, you just don't do that.
I think that's an important thing. I don't know if I think it was sexual, or even if the women who have been victim to this perceived it as sexual just from the you know, descriptions.
They seem to be saying that they don't.
They all seem to be saying that they don't. So that's not a question for me. But what I think what matters is that times haven't changed. How society talks about these kind of like uncomfortable moments has changed, but how they make the person feel has never changed. That's never been in question. The feelings have always been the same. And so I think that's important when we talk about, oh, he's older, he's from a different time. He made people feel uncomfortable in the same way that they'd feel uncomfortable now.
Yeah,
we just talked about it differently. Right.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see how people respond.
I thought it was a good apology. Now I'm having different
thoughts. We gotta go. Okay. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for watching, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.